I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In cities across Iraq, thousands chant the name of a radical Shiite cleric, Muqtada Sadr, who's now calling on his followers to rise up against the U.S. This comes at the same time as American Marines and Sunni Muslims trade gunfire in Fallujah.
These people hate freedom. And we love freedom, and that's where the clash occurs. See, we don't think freedom is America's gift to the world. We know that freedom is the Almighty's gift to every man and woman in this world.
With fighting now on two fronts, coming as it does just 11 weeks before the scheduled handover to Iraqi authorities, some American leaders are now talking about extending that deadline. Others are talking about sending more American soldiers to Iraq. In the last few hours, U.S. Marines are reported to have fired three rockets into a mosque in Fallujah, killing as many as 40 people. This coming just a day after 12 Marines died fighting in nearby Ramadi. And it's all firing up editorials like the one in the Wall Street Journal yesterday saying that, quote, if Mr. Bush fails to show that there is a price to pay for killing Americans, he might as well bring everyone home today. And so what are the options? More soldiers? More time? If the U.S. is forced to use increasing military strength, does it run the risk of adding just more fuel to the Iraqi insurgents? How do you see the battle lines in Iraq changing? We ask you to join us this hour. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us today from a studio in Washington, D.C., Amatzia Baram. He's a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and a professor of Middle Eastern history at the University of Haifa. Professor Baram, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
And here with me in my Boston studio, Robert Orr, Executive Director for Research at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Robert, nice to have you back.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It's getting hard to know where to turn your attention in Iraq, Robert, with this increase in fighting to the west of Baghdad, in Ramadi and Fallujah, and this unrest sort of boiling to the south. Is it fair to call it a war on two fronts at this point?
Absolutely, very fair. We have been focused for a number of months on the so-called Sunni Triangle, which is mostly to the west of Baghdad and reaching over to Baghdad. And in recent days, especially with the increased military strategy in Fallujah and Ramadi, that's where attention has been. But all along, there's been a latent second front with the radical Shia, and that has exploded in the streets of many cities in Iraq in recent days.
And Amatzia Baram, would you have us focus our attention more on the south than the west at this point in terms of what is happening or what could happen in the Shiite holy sites?
I would say that in the west, this is a purely military problem now. In the south, it's a very complicated military political problem. If you don't mind, I'll tell you why this situation is particularly worrisome, and there are four reasons. A, the simultaneity between Sunnis and Shiites, yes. B, there is a beginning of ultra-radical Sunni, ultra-radical Shiis cooperating against the coalition. C, this Muqtada Sadr, this upstart, very dangerous man, by the way, a criminal and to my mind mentally a bit problematic, is in a position now to eclipse the very senior leadership of the Shi'i communities, Ayatollah Sadr and four other grand ayatollahs. Growing public support for him in certain Shi'i areas is a major, major problem. And number four, timing. I'd only say one thing. There is a crisis of the constitution now, as we all know, and we are approaching within 4 days the what they call in Arabic Yawm al-Arba'in, the 40th day to the martyrdom, tragic martyrdom of Imam Hussein. People are flocking to Najaf, Karbala, Qazimain in Baghdad. 3 or 4 million people usually come on a day like that. What will happen if you have to fight a war when 3 million people, including from Iran, are coming to these cities? The combination is very worrisome.
And you, I want to just bring you back to the second point that you made, and that is talking about the fact that there are radical Sunni and radical Shiite now both taking on the U.S. on two different fronts. Are you saying that that's just serendipitous, or that there's some kind of coordination going on there?
Well, it started perfectly haphazard, just a coincidence. But there were, even before that, signs that Muqtada Sadr was supported by the most radical Sunni fundamentalist and pro-Saddam, or ex-Saddam supporters, on the Sunni side. Yes, there were some early signs, even almost 8 months ago. Now it's becoming more serious. For the first time, Saddam supporters and Islamist Sunnis are sending delegates to Shi'i areas to tell them, we are supporting you. Mm-hmm. The opposite hasn't yet happened, but it can happen. So I see this as a major, major danger. I'll only say one thing. Even though I'm at the U.S. Institute of Peace, this is a time of war. And in a case like that, very, very quick military victory on the Sunni part, and very quick political military operation in the south to make sure people are quiet, reject Muqtada Sadr, and allow the coalition forces to do away with his organization, the Mahdi Army. These are, to my mind, the orders of the day.
Okay, we'll get back, I think, to what the options for the United States are in working in the South. But I want to come back to Robert Orr in the studio here, because it's, I guess, just coincidental. But it is 1 year to the week when that statue of Saddam Hussein was pulled down in such a sort of public and celebratory way in Baghdad, and that I think a lot of people in this country, Robert, mark as the moment when the war for Baghdad didn't happen. You know, everybody was talking for months and months about, gosh, what's it going to be like fighting street to street? This is going to be the bloody part of the war. And I'm wondering, in your own sense of where we are now and where we're heading, if that's not really what's facing the United States right now, war on two fronts and an urban war.
Well, this is perhaps the underside of the war that didn't happen. It was great news at the time that we didn't see a lot of bloodshed in the streets of Baghdad and other major Iraqi cities. But all those people who had weapons simply melted back into the background. Well, a lot of those people who had weapons then and who have obtained those weapons since then are coming back out of the shadows. We've known all along that these people are there. Instead of having a sophisticated political strategy to marginalize them, we've focused just on the security problems. And in so doing, our security strategy and political strategy have gotten out of whack here.
Does it mean, though, that the U.S. has left itself in a position where the only way it has to respond to Muqtada Sadr, the only way it has to respond to any kind of uprising, is by simply using a greater amount of force than the insurgents?
That is a huge danger. All along, we've underplayed the political and the civilian side of the reconstruction. We have depended increasingly on the military side, and that equation should have been quite different. So it is still the biggest lever we have. But one of the things that we should be doing to put some of the political forces of moderation back in play is to start building coalitions among the moderates. Instead, we seem to be energizing the radicals, exactly the opposite of what we should be doing.
I want to play a little bit of tape from Brigadier General Mark Kimmett, who is Deputy Director of U.S. Military Operations in Iraq, at a press conference yesterday. He was asked about the options that the U.S. has at this particular point with these two fronts opening up, and specifically he's talking about what's happening with the Shiites in the south.
The extremists want to split the population from their government, from their security forces, and from the coalition, so that they can take this country back to an authoritarian regime as they had for so many years, or possibly even worse, take it back to some sort of Talibanization of this country where anarchy and chaos rule. We will conduct offensive operations. We will attack to destroy the Mahdi Army. Offensive operations will be deliberate, they will be precise, and they will be powerful, and they will succeed.
That's the U.S. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett. Amatzia Baram, when he speaks about using that kind of force to squash the Mahdi Army in the south, I'm imagining the use of rockets near a mosque and just what the effect of that would be. What would it be in your view?
Well, depending if Muqtada al-Sadr will be using a mosque as a shelter. A shelter, yes, but as a military position. You know that I was one of those people who did not criticize Saddam Hussein for ordering the tanks to shoot at the Ali Mosque in 1991, only for one reason, that the revolutionaries whom I did support, of course, chose to have their last stand in Ali's mosque, the most holy place, to the Shia, which to my mind was absolutely crazy. Now, if Muqtada al-Sadr and his supporters, who are now sitting in the Najaf mosque, in the most important place for Shia in the world, if they use it as a military fortress, if they start shooting, if they start killing American soldiers from there, I'm not sure what can be done about that. But my advice, at least, would be try to avoid mosques, of course, as much as possible. Mosques are holy places and should be respected.
Okay, but you made the point earlier in the program that this is a time when hundreds of thousands, perhaps even millions of people are going to be going to places in Karbala and Najaf. These are mobs insofar as the only news they get is what they hear from other people in the crowd. I mean, it's a mix, as you know, of educated and undereducated people, but that many people in one place takes on a completely different character.
Couldn't agree more, which means the moment people start marching towards Karbala and Najaf, towards the Yawm al-Arba'in, I would suggest, even if it means that you have to leave Muqtada al-Sadr alone for the time being, I would suggest withdraw, let him leave the mosque or stay in the mosque, whatever, until the whole thing is over. Until the Arba'in is over, there is not much you can do in the holy cities. You can do a lot in other places. You can defeat him in Kut, you can defeat him in Amara, you can defeat him in Nasiriyah. I understand they already managed to do that. But Najaf, Karbala, Qazimain, just keep away. You don't want any trouble. Respect the Islamic Shi'i traditions, and then hunt them down wherever you can.
Okay, let me, if I can, just for a moment, turn this to Bob Orr here in the studio, because in a number of these cities that Amatzia has described, Robert, the Mahdi army has occupied the government offices, has taken over the police stations. I mean, to what extent can the U.S. tolerate whatever small bit of civil development it had put in place being taken over? I mean, can they just sort of stand back and say, we'll deal with this at some point later on?
This is a very hard balancing act because, on one hand, the U.S. needs to prove that it stands with those Iraqis who it has trained and put forward as in leadership positions in the community. And at the same time, it has to avoid overreacting and setting off spirals of violence in all these different cities that both you and Amatzia mentioned. So it is a balancing act, but the same activities, the same approach is not necessary in every place. And I think that's something we need, an overall strategy, but it has to take into account the differences in each town.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. There are many questions here about the number of U.S. troops, the way they are deployed, the strategy, the politics, the religious aspect. It's suddenly become a much more complicated situation. Just as I said, 11 weeks before the scheduled handover to Iraqi authorities. What is the U.S. to do? Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for NPR.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We invite you to join our conversation this hour about the rapidly changing situation in Iraq, both with in conflict situations between the U.S. and the Sunni insurgents in Ramadi and Fallujah, also taking a look at all the unrest in the south. And to help us with a sort of latest of what's going on, we've got Dan Murphy on the line. Dan is Arab World Correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and he's joining us live on the line from Baghdad. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. I'm wondering, as a reporter in Baghdad, how it is you figure out what story you're supposed to be covering. There seems to be so much going on at the same time.
Yeah, you just try to swing a dead cat in circles until it hits something, and usually that happens the moment you walk out the front door of the hotel these days. There is a lot going on, but there are some common themes drawing them together, and the biggest one is a blossoming insurgency that's multi-front and multi-dimensional that is challenging American plans for transition in Iraq, and is certainly going to require new solutions and responses in the days and months to come, and nobody knows what those are yet.
Well, we've been talking earlier in the program about just how complicated it is for the United States in trying to balance the politics with the religion, with the military response in the South. What's the latest from cities to the South? Who's in charge? What's the Mahdi army up to?
It depends where you go. If you go to Sadr City, which is a sprawling slum of about 2 million people on the north of Baghdad, the Mahdi army are around. There are a lot of American tanks around also. There aren't any engagements at the moment, but they're largely in control of that area, and Iraqi police and security forces have withdrawn completely. They're invisible. If we move further south to a city like Al-Kut, which was one of the most peaceful cities in Iraq up until a couple of months ago, Ukrainian forces have been pushed out of the city by the Mahdi army, and for the moment, they've seized control there. So what we're seeing is sort of these little mini rebellions blossoming kind of all over the place, and that's very difficult sort of a problem to deal with.
And usually, Dan, I don't know if it's the case right now, but usually whatever is happening elsewhere in the country is in some way reflected on the streets of Baghdad itself. You talked about Sadr City being a very tense place. But even where you are now and in your efforts to try and work, are you seeing this escalation in overall tension?
Oh, there's no question there's an escalation in overall tension and also threat to people like me. On the streets of Qadamiya, which is a middle-class suburb yesterday, there was some very distant gunfire, and by very distant, I mean miles away probably. And the moment people heard it, they began running for their shutters and their shops and pulling their furniture off the street as if they were about to be engulfed by full-fledged warfare. Also in that neighborhood, I was threatened by members of the Mahdi Army who eventually decided not to arrest me at knife point. I was able to leave. But these are all very, very new phenomenons. And that incident I'm describing is really a very prosperous place in the center of Baghdad.
And what are you hearing from the American troops in terms of their ability to juggle fronts in the West and this escalation of tension in the South?
Well, the official word is that, you know, we are the most well-trained, best-led army in the world, and we can confront any challenge, and we will be crushing our opponents. And that was the word out of Brigadier General Kimmett, who's the chief military spokesman here today. I think if you talk to soldiers, they're certainly bewildered with the pace of change, with the many fronts that they're dealing with. And I think that they're all grappling with the problem of counterinsurgency. How do you go after the people who are armed and fighting you in the midst of large civilian populations without turning even greater number of people to arms against you? And it's always something that an occupying army is going to struggle with, and more often than not, they're going to lose that struggle because it's so hard.
Dan, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Dan Murphy is Arab World correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, on the line there live from Baghdad. And we're going to stay in Baghdad for a couple of minutes because Fuad Hussein is joining us from there. He's an advisor to the Ministry of Education, has been a guest on the Connection before. And Fuad, it's good to hear your voice again. How are you?
Thank you. How are you?
I think I'm in a slightly safer place than you are right now. I'm interested in just how the people who you're working with are reacting to all this news of change in the South and the fighting to the west of Baghdad.
Of course, the situation has been very much complicated here in Baghdad, but also for our people in the South and some cities. Some cities has been occupied by the supporters of Muqtada Sadr or the Mahdi army. So the situation has been very much complicated here and in the South.
Are you seeing people getting drawn into the rhetoric that we've been hearing from Muqtada Sadr? Are you seeing Shiites in Baghdad saying, yeah, this guy is articulating a sort of anti-American notion that we will support?
Of course, among the Shias, there are the majority silent. They have not that power to express their views. Mostly they are intellectuals and individual. But Muqtada Sadr has got a lot of support from a poorer area, as it has been mentioned in the city of Al Sadr, which is in Baghdad. There are about 2 million Shiites there, and most of the young people and poor people gradually began to support Muqtada Sadr and his movement. And that's also the same in the south. So he is getting support from poorer people, young people, also from ex-Baathists and who were Shiite, who were working with the Iraqi government, and now they have changed their mind. They are supporting Muqtada Sadr. So his support is growing among these groups.
One of the guests on the program with me this hour, Fuad, is Amatzia Baram. He's in a studio in Washington, and he's got a question for you. Amatzia, go ahead.
Fuad, ahlan wa sahlan. Can you tell us a little bit about the position of Ayatollah Uzma Ali Sistani? Where does he stand? Is he supportive of Muqtada Sadr? Is he against him? Is he against riots and demonstration? Is he encouraging people maybe to start shooting? Because this is a critical, it's not only him, it's also the four other Grand Ayatollahs who usually are in agreement with him in Najaf. Where is Al-Hawza Al-Almiya?
And I should just point out for our listeners that Grand Ayatollah yes. Ali Sistani is generally regarded as a moderate leader, religious leader, very highly regarded cleric, but someone who has kept this kind of uprising from happening. So, Fuad, over to you.
Yeah, that's an important question, actually. The position of Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani is still asking people to protest quietly and peacefully, and he expressed also his sympathy for the victims in the last days. But politically, I think he is in a very dangerous position. He is staying and living in Najaf, and Najaf in these days is in the hands of Muqtada Sadr and his supporters. And I think if Sadr will be, Muqtada Sadr will be the strongest man in the south, in the future, it will threaten his position also. Because in the past, the relationship between Muqtada Sadr and Ayatollah Ali Sistani was not so positive. But the question is, what can he do, especially he has been, he doesn't have a military power. He has got a moral power. But still, he is in the city, and the city has been occupied by Muqtada Sadr's supporters. And Muqtada has declared yesterday that some people around Ayatollah Ali Sistani are supporting him. Of course, nobody knows if that is true or not. But anyway, the position of Ayatollah Ali Sistani would be very important. And I think within a few days, he's going to express his mind. And if he is going to support Muqtada Sadr, then we will have a huge problem. But if he will distance himself for all the movement and from Muqtada Sadr, then Muqtada Sadr will be in problem. But until now, he didn't have that clear position.
Fuad, I'm curious how you are looking at it. You've come back to live in Iraq after many years abroad, but you made a decision to work with the American-led Coalition Provisional Authority. And I'm wondering if you're becoming in any way increasingly worried about your own safety there as so much anti-U.S. rhetoric is heard from Iraq.
Of course, we are all worried about our safety, not only about personal safety, but also the safety of many people around us. It is not easy. But at the end, this is our country, and we want it, and we are trying to build a democratic system in this country. What is going on now here and in the south is really dangerous for that process of democratization of Iraq. But at the end, we are worried about everything, and not only about ourselves.
Fuad, thanks so much for being with us. You take care, okay?
Thank you. You're welcome.
Fuad Hussein is an advisor to the Ministry of Education, joining us there live on the line from Baghdad. A reminder, our number is 1-800-423-8255. And I guess in trying to make sense of what's going on in Iraq, it's important to try and make sense of it with looking at it also through the eyes of the U.S. administration and their options. Robert Orr is here with me in the studio. Robert, June 30th deadline is starting to look like kind of a shaky date, despite what the president said just a day ago.
If the U.S. has a strategy, a political strategy in Iraq, it's hard to tell what it is today. So far, the mantra has been June 30th is a hard date. We're going to stick to it, even though it's an arbitrary one. We will hand over to an Iraqi government, even though we don't know who that government is. Four of the assumptions that have been at the core of being able to hand over have just collapsed in the last 48 to 72 hours. First, that the moderates under Sistani were a much stronger force than Sadr. Second, that the radicals in the Sunni community and the radicals in the Shia community could not and would not work together. Third, that the Mahdi army was a small group of 3,000 people. We've seen many more than 3,000 armed people in the streets. And lastly, that Iraqification was a process well underway, that we've built up police and local structures that could stand. We've seen local police forces and local officials disappear or switch sides every time when confronted in recent days. So if we had a political strategy 72 hours ago, I'm not at all clear what it is now.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call from Newport News, Virginia, and Nate's with us. Hi, Nate. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. The comment I wanted to make was that I believe that we are now seeing that we are reaping the rewards, if you want to call them that, of the Bush administration's choice at the beginning of the war to wage this war basically on the cheap. Now, you know, when things were first getting started, a lot of senior advisors at the Pentagon really wanted to send in a lot more troops than we ended up doing. Rumsfeld and the rest of the neocons were able to sell the idea that we could do this with a lot less force. And as a result, there was an enormous amount of chaos at the beginning of the war, and we were unable to provide the necessary levels of security that we really should have had in order to win the hearts and minds of the people.
So, Nate, let me just jump this ahead a minute. Are you saying that it's now too late to dramatically increase the force as a way of resolving what you're describing?
Well, I think we're going to be stuck with dramatically increasing the force, but I'm highly skeptical that this is going to have a positive conclusion for the United States.
Okay.
I really do kind of fear that it's too late, and I'd be interested to hear what your guests have to say on that subject, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for your call. In fact, we're going to hear from both of them on this because I think it's a pretty crucial point. Amatzia Baram, the tension that currently exists between people in the different Iraqi cities and the U.S. occupation, I mean, could that be in any way mollified by sending in more soldiers, making life on the street a lot safer for the people who are kind of caught in the middle here?
You mean from the outset?
If the soldiers were sent in now, if there was a dramatic increase in the number of U.S. soldiers there now?
The way I look at it now, I think you have a sufficient number of soldiers to put down the insurrection if it doesn't spread much wider. It may not spread. I cannot tell. It's much too early to say.
Mm-hmm.
I would prepare forces just in case there is need to send more forces. But right now, you have the military advantage and you have time right after the 40th day, this commemoration day, you have time and you have the soldiers. If things go much worse, then you'll have to have more soldiers. But as I think Fuad Hussein mentioned from Baghdad, much depends. I'd say 90% of the future depends on the position of Grand Ayatollah Sistani and his group of Grand Ayatollahs in Najaf, because if he's calling upon people to desist from fighting,
right,
and to go home, and then things will get eventually much better. If he doesn't do that, you may need more soldiers.
Okay, Robert.
this is not just a question of the number of forces. While that is an important issue that the military leadership needs to determine and the president needs to follow, it's also a question of the kind of forces, and we've been changing the composition of the forces, unfortunately, a bit too late, it would appear. But it's also the key question is under what auspices these forces are serving. The occupation is highly unpopular. Resistance is one of the few things that is giving Iraqis pride. We need to give other things that can allow Iraqis to express themselves and feel proud of what they're doing. So it's the occupation question, and I think related to that, the fact that this still is seen as an American enterprise of subjugation. Until we broaden, again, we've missed so many opportunities to broaden the international coalition. We have to get serious and make some major changes that will allow a different umbrella to appear so Iraqis don't see an occupation every day.
I mean, it's pretty broad now just in terms of the number of flags there, not the number of soldiers necessarily, but we read stories about Italians being wounded in Nasiriyah and a Ukrainian soldier was killed a couple of days ago in Kut, and Bulgarians and Poles are fighting in Kabul. In fact, 18 of 26 of the NATO nations have a presence there. So what's the difference between what's there now and what you're saying needs to change in a way that would appeal to Iraqis?
First, you are absolutely right. It is the number of flags, not the number of soldiers, that is, looks like a broad coalition. But most importantly, it is the mandate under which they're serving, and it's the appearance of an American head running Iraq. Until that political profile changes, and it looks like a benign international led transition to an Iraqi government, this is going to still be difficult. Right now, Lakhdar Brahimi, the Secretary General's representative, is in Baghdad. He's in Iraq undergoing a number of consultations. The tragedy of these last couple days would be if somehow the uprisings and the responses would keep the UN out. In fact, there is an important role for the UN, and the U.S. has to be the one to make sure that happens.
So very briefly, just a couple of seconds to our break, that means blue helmet, UN blue helmets, not necessarily a NATO force.
Correct, though NATO could also be a part of this, but under that broader auspice.
1-800-423-8255, that's the number to join our conversation this hour as we're talking about America's options in dealing with the current situation in Iraq, uprising in the West, unrest in the South, and some difficult choices ahead. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for National.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me on the program this hour, Amatzia Baram, who is a senior fellow at the United States Institute of Peace, a professor of Middle Eastern history at the University of Haifa, and author of a number of books looking specifically at the Ba'athist Party and Saddam Hussein. Robert Orr is here with me in the Boston studio. He's director of research, executive director of research at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. That's it. Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's a former vice president of the Council on Foreign Relations and co-author of Keeping the Peace, Lessons from Multidimensional Peace Operations in Cambodia and El Salvador. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to hear from you. And we're going next to Ashland, Massachusetts. Imran's with us. Hi, Imran.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. The question I have is, in light of the cruelty that was displayed with the four people that were hung up and kind of the desire to escalate things, has Paul Bremer actually, thought about negotiating with this guy Sadr and asking, what exactly are they looking for, and is there a way to try to involve them politically rather than, I think my sense of things is that the coalition or the CPA basically telling Iraqis how things are going to be as far as their government goes. So in other words, giving Sadr and other people more of a participatory role in their future.
Okay, just one clarification. It was, in fact, the Sunni Muslims in Fallujah who were involved in the killing and the sort of grisly mutilation of the American who were killed there But I think your question is an excellent one for Amatzia here in terms of why it is that so far there hasn't been that kind of conciliatory conversation between Paul Bremer and this radical cleric. Cleric, maybe even stretching it a little bit, Amatzia, when we talk about Muqtada Sadr. What's your view?
Well, as far as I know, there were contacts with him. Not between him and Bremer directly, but Bremer's people were talking to his people and even to him. And apparently, as far as I know, it reached a crisis level. It was so simply not fruitful. In fact, Muqtada reminds me, I think I said it once, Muqtada reminds me very much of Saddam Hussein when he was his age. They are both criminals. They're both.
Why do you call him a criminal? That's twice you've done that.
I'll tell you why. Because he established a state within a state today. He has his own courts, which are not the state courts. And he has his militia carrying out his court's orders. They are beating people. They are arresting and torturing people. They have killed people. As far as we know, at least, that has to go into the court first. Mm-hmm. But there is a very serious evidence that he's behind the butchering of Ayatollah Abdelmajid Khoi in April 1 year ago in the Grand Mosque of Najaf. The man is a thug. And he reminds me very much of Saddam because he's rising through his militia. Same thing that Saddam did through the Baath and his own tribesmen. And
can I ask you a question about him? There's an observation that I've heard that I don't quite understand, and that is that Muqtada Sadr speaks a sort of street-level Arabic, and that is
correct.
A very revealing feature of the man. What can you explain that?
Absolutely. Yes, Muqtada Sadr, like Saddam, again, very reminiscent, speaks street language. It's Baghdad colloquial Shi'i Arabic. It's not even the Iraqi. There is no Iraqi colloquial Arabic. It's like you have a number of them. And he cannot speak literary Arabic at all. He is...
Which is the language of educated men? Is that
yes,
the distinction?
Yes, anybody with any religious education in Iraq can speak very, especially in the Shi'i part, can speak very, very nice literary Arabic. It shows some kind of intellectual inclination. Muqtada Sadr is an anti-intellectual. He's a bully. Now, he also comes from a very, very important family, hugely important. The Sadr family is tremendously important in Iraq as a religious, intellectual family. His father was a very important Grand Ayatollah, murdered by Saddam. So you have here a totally different kind of person, something even more important. Well, that's important for his personality trait and so on, but more important politically. The man has managed. He's anything but stupid. He may be not very highly educated, but he's very bright. And by the way, Saddam too was not very well educated, but very, very bright. And what he is doing, he is now developing a messianic trend in contemporary Shia, which to my mind is amazing, but it seems to work on some people. His people now, in their prayers, are calling him the son of the Mahdi. The son of the Mahdi. He established an army, which he calls the Mahdi's army. The Mahdi is, of course, the Shi'i Messiah.
Let me just ask you to hold on for half a second here, and I want to turn it back to Robert Orr. This presents a very, very difficult dilemma for the United States, because if the man wears the turban of a cleric and encourages his followers to praise him in religious terms rather than in military terms, and yet, as Amatzia says, his strength comes from the men on the street with guns, what can the United States do? Do they have to confront him militarily? Are there any other options?
The United States and the United Nations have a long history of negotiating even with the worst thugs. If you can get peace with Pol Pot in Cambodia, if you can negotiate a peace between the various parties in Bosnia, there is always another option. The idea that crushing him is the only option is absurd. The question is, this is not the kind of person you would want to see ruling Iraq. So you can deal with him. You can build a political process in which he plays a part. I think it's still not too late to see a broader coalition of Shia, Sunni, and Kurd that could run Iraq in which he would not be a principal player.
But if he taunts the United States into a military confrontation, then that plays in part or completely to his advantage.
Absolutely plays to his advantage, and your word is just right, taunts. If we respond in kind of street language in kind and get down in the gutter and brawl with him, he will only gain from this.
All right, let's go back to our phones, to Roxbury, Massachusetts. Siddiqui's with us. Hi, Siddiqui.
How you doing?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Good. Look, I was calling because of the fact that, you know, I have a totally different viewpoint from what I'm hearing here.
Yeah.
I believe that, you know, that the tide has turned and that there's no way in the world that this war can won, that can be won, that the guerrillas, from a psychological and tactical perspective, have run a brilliant campaign. Now, last spring, when the war was on the brink, there were those in the euphoria saying this is going to be a seven-day war, and I theorized with some criticism that this was actually going to be a guerrilla war, that they allowed the U.S. to come in there as they did, and that what they did was they came in on the guerrilla's terms. So what you have when a guerrilla, and I consider myself to be a student of guerrilla warfare and fascinated by it, is that you have to win the hearts and the minds of the people, not in terms of Iraq, but here in this country.
Okay, Siddiqui, if you've studied this stuff, then what are the alternatives for the United States at this point? If they've been drawn that far down the forest path, then what's left?
Well, the only alternative is that, and I think this is, you know, has to be a last-ditch effort, is that it has to become an international situation. I mean, that won't completely eliminate the problem, but as it is right now, the United States is looked upon as the folks who, in fact, are the invaders and, in fact, are occupying the land. And what's happening is that they talk about the number of U.S. troops that are killed, but they don't talk about the fact that thousands of Iraqis are being killed.
Right.
So what happens is that the whole population in there is gradually starting to turn against this occupation. So this is George Bush's Chechnya.
Let me ask Amatzia Baram here, Siddiqui, whether or not if the leadership, if the Western leadership suddenly was not American, does that take away the big bad wolf as far as someone like Muqtada Sadr is concerned? Does he lose his choice target then if the Americans step aside for a more international force?
Well, this, to my mind, is a theoretical question, mainly because I don't see the UN sending troops into Iraq. It could be blue helmets, but it will still be under American command, and most soldiers will still be American.
Right.
So this is, practically speaking, this is not going to happen. My view is, of course, the more internationalization, the better. But in a situation like right now, what is now happening, I'm not sure how it devolved into what it is. We'll have to hear more details. But as things are now, at least my judgment is, it's very different from Robert's, it's very clear, that if the American command decides now to give in, to completely leave everything, allow Muqtada Sadr to take, which he has already done, Najaf, he will take also
Karbala,
he'll take also Qazimain, he'll take also Kut, he'll take also, I'd say, 20 or 30 towns in the Shia area in Iraq. He'll establish his own government. I'm full of admiration for people like Robert, who thinks that you can talk to every thug. Yes, you can talk to many thugs, but not to every thug. And sometimes there is a historical moment, maybe there was a way of doing something beforehand, which I'm not so sure. They tried, they failed.
Let's hear Robert defend his position.
At the present, it would be, to my mind, only I can say, disastrous.
Let me just say that I did not say and would not say that we should in any way give in to Sadr. It is war by another means, politics. We have to isolate him. We can't isolate him if we simply go tit for tat with him. There is a role for the American military to push his people out of the control of the various town halls that he's taken. We need to do that. But if we don't follow the kind of strategy that you mentioned earlier in the program, and that is give some space to the holy cities for the next few days and get some political coalitions built that can keep him penned in, then we are really looking at turning the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people, in particular the fulcrum in the Shia community, against us. And that would be disastrous.
I'm going to try and sneak in another call here. And that comes from Greensboro, North Carolina. Newton, Massachusetts. It's John on the line. John, hi.
Yes, I want to be quick. I'll just give a couple sentences. I find it strange that a view that's embraced now by 40% of the American people, that the troops should get out now, is not being voiced on the program. That's number one.
John,
number
what two, do you think about that? Do you think the troops should go?
Absolutely. The hundreds, thousands of lives have been wasted for what Jimmy Carter has called an unnecessary and unjust war. That's absolutely true. And the second thing is, I find it strange to have an Israeli commentator on when the pro-Likudnik faction in the Bush administration has had an awful lot to do with waging this war, which is seen in Israel.
John, I don't check the passports of the people who come into the program. We bring people on based on their academic credentials, and Mitzia Baram has been with us before and will be with us again. But I am interested in the first part of what you said, and I'm going to direct that part first to Robert Orr, and that's the 40% of Americans who are saying, just maybe this isn't worth it. I mean, it is quite an interesting number.
This has been a, no question about it, a very poorly waged campaign by the Bush administration. We went in the wrong way with the wrong coalition. We've made bad judgments at various parts. But should we just pull the troops out now? If we were to do that, chaos. No question, chaos would ensue. And that's not just for Iraq. That would bring in all of the regional actors. We would see a meltdown scenario in the Middle East, very likely, and that would be truly unacceptable. And we would, I think, share the blame for that. Having started this thing down this path, if we were to abandon it right now, it would be chaos.
And briefly, Amatzia, to the people who are thinking about, well, maybe it'd be chaos for a few months, but maybe it would be better in the long run, like a year or so from now. Do you agree with Robert on this, that it would just spiral out of control?
I agree with Robert completely. By the way, also regarding the previous things he said about what is needed to be done, yes, a coalition has to be formed with the moderates. But I'll say one thing. I can see one scenario under which the coalition will have indeed to withdraw from Iraq. If the majority of the Shia turn against you with rifles, then you'll have no choice. I think we are very far from that, very far. But such a possibility theoretically exists. But now I agree absolutely with Robert.
Amatzia, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
It's my pleasure.
Amatzia Baram is a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Robert Orr, thanks again so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Robert is executive director for research at the Belfer Center at the Kennedy School of Government. Earlier in the program, we talked with Fuad Hussein, an advisor to the Ministry of Education in Iraq, and Dan Murphy, who is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We'll